Now I'd like to introduce Osama Kashour. Osama is one of the founders, actually, of the Free Gaza movement. And Osama was on the land team. That's how I got to know him. One of the main coordinators of the very first Break the Siege expedition, which I was a member of, and did a lot of work. And obviously, he will tell us about the Marmara, the Mavi Marmara experience. Mm. And Osama, the floor is
yours. Thank you very much. I've got two things, first of all. The first thing I am going to do is to ask you a question, which I'll come to later. And the second thing, I'm going to make your life not very good, Steve. I'm sorry. Because I'm not going to be sitting in this chair. I've been sitting for a long time. Guys, who does agree with me that our war, our cause, is a media war? Can I see? Okay. So, everybody agrees that's a media war. What we were doing in the middle of the sea, it was a media success in getting the story out. Okay? What we've done, we managed basically to trick the Israeli media war, the Israeli forces, and we managed to get our story out there. What Israel done to us in the middle of the international water, yes, it's horrendous because you've all seen it on TV. Yes, it's horrendous because most of the world managed to see it on TV. And yes, it's horrendous for the Israeli because they couldn't stop our cameras. Yeah? So from this point, if I just get out of this room with your commitment that each single one of you is going to encourage two people, including yourself, so three, and write to the BBC and write to your local media, thank them or criticize them. Can I get this commitment from you? It's the least we can do for the people who die every day. Can you please do it? Thank you very much. Because when we support the media, when we support those who speak on our behalf in BBC and Channel 4 and ITN and all the newspapers, they will write more and their editors will see that there's an audience who are appreciating them and they will encourage them. And instead, there is a small office in London, and the only thing this office does in London is write complaint letters or thanks letters. Three people write hundreds of thousands of letters, which is already there. It's an empty outplay that they could be on base, and then they send some chicks. So just do the same thing. Let us appreciate the media and not just sit down there and complain. Oh, you know, and curse the media that didn't do anything. Okay, I'll just go back to the meeting. A lot of things to say. You know, just being on this flotilla is an endless amount of stories. Which does give you an idea about the solidarity, the feeling, and it does give you an idea about this huge movement that nothing will describe it but an anti-apartheid movement, an anti-slavery movement, and it is the sort of movement that we witness happening in the UK to end the apartheid in South Africa and to end the slavery in America. And this is your chance. Everybody who's in this room, everybody who's got a family, it's your chance to take part, to be part of this global movement which is going to end the Israeli arrogancy, terrorism and apartheid in Palestine and incubation. So it's an invitation to all of you. Invite your friends. Get the honor of being in this movement. It's not because I'm just a Palestinian I'm saying this, but it's really an unjust thing that's happening in Gaza Strip in Palestine, and we ought to be part of ending it. Going back to Mavi Marmara. So I actually was, you know, one of those guys who started the Free Gaza movement, and we wanted to kind of move a little bit step further of just whinging and talking and going to the street and marching and writing and doing all that rubbish. So we wanted to kind of...
That's not rubbish.
I'm sorry. But we wanted to get this... I mean, I feel frustrated. How many people feel frustrated? We go 1 million in the street, anti-war, and they all go to war, okay? Yeah. So we need to get out there and try and move this anger, this activism into a different platform. And people are hungry, and if you provide a different platform, they won't say no, they will come on board. If you say we're going to go into Gaza, bye, hi, say hello. Thank you. So if we say we can go to Gaza by sea, we've got enough believers, and we can do it. If there is a way, there is?
A well.
Okay, and we've done it. We got crazy people like Mushir saying, oh, we'll come to Gaza, I'll go to Gaza. And then another one from there, then one from there. We have 42 people who really committed themselves to come to Gaza, and we were trying to convince ourselves we can't get them to Gaza. You know what? We didn't know that we can. We were building boats in our hands. We did not experience at all. We bought the boats in the different size, so we were steering right, and they would go left, steer left, go right. We have half engine. We created a position for a guy who will run between the captain and the engine room because there's no communication, the engine is not working. And I don't know how we got to Gaza, but this is what we got to Gaza. I mean, they were seasick all the way through, but they got to Gaza. They didn't believe it. The guys in Gaza didn't believe it. They thought that's Israeli, like, undercover forces coming to Gaza. It was complete, but we've done it. We made history, okay? And that instigates the flotilla. And this flotilla, we just got even more believers to come on board. We've got the energy and love that Alex was talking about on board. It was amazing. People from all of these countries coming, meeting each other, networking. Each one is representing another group. We've got Malaysia, Indonesia, with China, with Venezuela, with Macedonia, with Spain, with Turkey, with Palestine, with Israel, with Italy, with... you name it, Mauritania, Ethiopia, for God's sake. We've got some people from Somalia coming, from everywhere. So suddenly you have the international community in that one ship, communicating, networking, talking, and organizing. It's what was really lovely and beautiful to see. So what I was doing on that ship, I was doing some of the media. Okay, you were trying to kind of provoke those who are not on board, like BBC. I'll show you this email from BBC. I love it. I'm going to print it out and give it to everybody. So we just sent a letter to our supporters, say like, call BBC and complain. You don't know why you're complaining, but call them and say, why are you not coming to the hotel? And I've got this letter from the head of BBC saying, please, 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 can you ask your supporters to stop calling us? We're receiving 250 calls per hour. They can't receive any calls but these calls. We promised we're going to cover it. And I'm very grateful that they didn't have a reporter on board. So we start giving them free pictures and free videos. That's what the British create. The British create BBC not to cover us, but to cover us. I've got the email, I'll send it to you, Mashir. Anyway, so I was doing the media thing, I make sure that the camera is going in the right direction. Blah, blah, blah. In the media team on the boat, we have two plans. One plan that everybody knows, and the frequency that everybody knows. And the other plan is basically we knew that they're going to stop that. We have a secret frequency that we kind of went through after they jumped all our communication signal. And it was, you know, we were doing our best and anticipating the Israeli soldiers to intercept us 60 miles away from Gaza. So we knew for our cameras to function, we will delay, we'll try and get to that conflict area by daytime. So you remember an announcement, we announced to the passengers, get a very early night's sleep. Tomorrow by 7 o'clock in the morning, we're expecting to be intercepted by the Israeli Navy. Make sure that your belongings are with you. Make sure that you are really ready to be part of like the siege, because we were expecting a siege. We were expecting them to kind of use gas, rubber bullets. We never thought of live ammunition, but using live ammunition against civilians in sea, it's an act of cowardice and terrorism. And we didn't believe that anybody in the whole world still exists in 2010 who will use such a barbaric act. So we're not prepared at all. And by 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, we are aware that there is some activities around. And we have communication with the captain. He said that there is like, you know, there's two ships approaching very fast. And actually, the Israeli Navy initiate a contact with the captain, asking him to identify himself and where about he's going, etc., etc. So we thought, something is happening. Something wrong is going on. So people start getting ready, you know, grabbing whatever chair they can get their hands on, bottles. We bought the life jackets, and we were just basically just observing and watching. By 4 o'clock, just by the morning prayers, when the brothers were getting ready to pray, I saw at least six vessels, speedy boats from each side approaching the ship. And we thought, because we've done it before, they will escort us and they will just like, you know, what's happening? And then they will go away. So we didn't like, you know what's happening. And then slowly, 15 minutes later, they start approaching the ship, three of the boats, and the other three boats behind them were covering them. And then they start pushing their ladders and went to be on board. And obviously, the reaction of us, as we announced that we're going to defend our ship, we will not give pirates, soldiers, whatever, control our ship. It's our ship. So we start pushing them. For 25 minutes, we managed to give them away from the ship, from the land, from the bottom of the ship. So every time we put the ladder, they will be pushed by sticks, by chains, or whatever. By the way, this picture that you saw from the Israeli side, it's not completely wrong. It's correct. And we are using sticks, we're using fishing ropes, we're using chairs to defend our ship. Okay? And it's not a secret. So, I mean, they claim that we attacked the Israeli soldiers. I mean, I don't know what you call it. Like, yes, we attacked you because you were having gun and shooting us. And I'll tell you what happened. So after they failed, and I'm going to talk about my personal journey with this because it's I think you'll relate to it maybe more. So when we managed to kind of block them successfully from boarding the ship from the bottom, I don't know how, but suddenly we hear huge noise, wind from all over, and then we realize there's a helicopter on top. We didn't realize there are three helicopters. There's one here, the other there, and one in the middle, dropping soldiers. And I've realized now it's three helicopters because of the pictures that I've seen. And then I kind of start kind of, so that's what was happening. Because it was dark, it was middle of the night, they jumped our signal, and we didn't know exactly what happened. And these soldiers start like lowering themselves down, and obviously the guys who were next to the captain room, they start fighting them and, you know, swinging the rope and whatever. And I was on the second roof, and I was filming and trying to kind of concentrate on what's happening and trying to get kind of communication to the rest of the crew and stuff. And suddenly something fell in my head. I didn't know what it was. Was it like a small something? Is it a bag? Is it a human being? I didn't know. It was dark. It was very quick. I was very confused. Noise. And we've got fire alarm out. We've got the emergency alarm out. It was completely chaotic. And then I looked down at this fucking soldier down there. And he's scared. And he's looking at me. He's scared. And I was scared as well. What the hell? But then he grabbed his Uzi. Do you know what is Uzi? It's a small gun. And he starts shooting, and I just like jumped to the other side of the guy and caught his hand, and I put it up, and he starts shooting. I was nearly killed. So I was putting his hands up and just talking to him, like, just put it down. And then two guys realized that there's something wrong happening, and they just came and they start helping me. And we managed to disarm him from his gun and from his pistol and from his other guns. He's got three guns on him. So we disarmed him completely, successfully. He was a little bit bruised, and then somebody hit me and I just fainted, and you know, I was taken away and I was rescued and whatever, and these soldiers were taken down. We captured five soldiers. We disarmed them. We had at least 20 guns with us. Okay. These guns were thrown back into the sea. These soldiers were taken down. Of course, I'm not going to say they were not beaten. They were beaten as they had been disarmed because they were resisting as well, and they were taken down to the hospitals, and in the hospital they were treated by the sisters and then taken back to their comrade from the other door. Yeah? One of the Malaysian doctors who was taking them back, he was shot as he was taking one of the soldiers back. This is the stories that nobody needs to know. If we wanted to use violence and attack the soldiers, we would have attacked them by guns. I can tell you, there would be at least 30 soldiers dead. And we would have taken soldiers with us down. But that's not what we went to do. We would not... You know, we didn't go to Gaza to kill other people or to arrest other people or to use violence. We did say that loudly and clearly. And we did tell them we are going to Gaza with a simple message of solidarity, and we're taking with us a humanitarian aid. And if we are going to be intercepted, we're going to defend ourselves and we're going to resist. And if we are being forced to go back, we will go back. But definitely we can't stay in the sea if our engine is going to run out of petrol. And we definitely are not willing to accept the Israeli Navy offer of helping us if we're stuck in the middle of the sea, because that's what turned the whole story upside down. So the idea will be there, to go there, stay there for a few days, a week maximum, and then go back. Just to prove our point. We knew that 15,000 tons that we have with us on this flotilla, you know, Gaza Strip need 25,000 tons of supplies a day. Okay? 25,000. We have with us 15,000. Yes, Gaza does need them, but we were challenging the foundation of what create this need and this disaster in Gaza. We were not going just to deliver this humanitarian aid to Gaza. And we made that here and now. That's why the offers to go through Egypt and through Al Arish and through Ashdod was refused, because you don't get it, guys. It's nothing about us delivering this 15,000 ton. It's about the reason which create this disaster that we are challenging. It's the attitude. It's the silence. It's our siege that we're trying to break. Your siege. That's what takes us to the international water and challenging the Israeli kind of powerful hate and terrorist machine. Anyway. So then I was with Alex before the attack of a few hours. We were trying to discover a few ways of confronting the Israeli Navy. And we had two powerful tools, according to my version of the story. And these two tools were onions and mirrors. I'll explain why. Okay? So I fired Alex to go and collect all the mirrors from all the women in the ship. All their kind of, you know, makeup mirrors. And I made sure that the kebab, the last meal of kebab that we ate on the ship, we ate through the onions. And of course, as a Palestinian, you know, onions are very good for tear gas, so we're fully prepared for that. And the mirrors, not to reflect their evil behavior, which there's some certain element of truth in that, but all, you know, because we knew that mirrors could sometimes reflect the radar signal, and if, you know, we could maybe either abstract their communication or just, you know, I don't know. Just, you know, when you're in a desperate situation, you try, you know, how do you say it in English? The sink, in Palestine we say, if you're sinking, you hold into
Straw.
Yeah, straw. If you're sinking, you hold it to a straw. That's what happens to us. If we are sinking, we hold it to a mirror and telling you. And it just, I don't know, we really tried our best. Okay?
Osama, were you trying to throw the onions at them or getting them to sniff the onions?
No, us.
Oh, against the tear gas.
Yeah,
Hillary. Tear gas, not onions. Sorry. Although, I don't know, I think there are a few onions being chucked into the sea. Anyway, so I was on the second floor when I start hearing this sound of live bullets and dum-dum. And for those who know dum-dum, dum-dum is a very scary live ignition, which when it goes through your skin and hit your bone, it explodes. And that's the most deadly bullets, and they don't use it if they don't want to kill. So I dropped the onions in the mirrors, and I was going all over the direction, asking people to take shelter because they are killing people. They are killing people. And then I was talking about my friend Gaudat, who's a guy who was the official photographer of the whole flotilla, and just shouting, take a shelter, and, you know, take a shelter. And I continued screaming onions because I thought that everybody understand onions. But I just went like, take a shelter, take a shelter. So he was, Gaudat was here, and there's steps that's filming. He was filming the helicopters. And I was running in this corridor, and in this corridor, there's a little kind of shelter here. So I'm running between this corridor and the other corridor, pushing people downstairs, trying to convince them it's dum-dum, for those who doesn't understand English. And just pointing in this corridor. And I went back, just literally seconds. Gaudat was taking these pictures, and he was on the ground. And he's taking shelter. And I just like give them a few seconds. Gaudat, he didn't listen, he didn't respond. So I thought, okay, he's injured. So I went back to him. And that, you know, that time when you just move from here to here, it's about 5 meters, you can see the bullets and the reflection of the bullets and the wind of the bullets, and yes, we've seen a lot of American movies, but trust me, that wasn't a movie. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a 3D movie, oh my god. I just grabbed Gaudat, and he wasn't moving, and I put my hand, if you don't mind, underneath his arm, and I'm just pulling him, protecting his head because he was bouncing. Another guy came and helped me, and we dragged him to the shelter. I could see some scratch in his head. I thought he's fainted. And then I looked harder. It's like this small scratch, but it's a bit deeper. And then I realized something warm in my hand. And then I looked down, and it was his brain spinning from behind. It's exploded from the back, like this. I was very emotional. It was very disturbing. And then the doctor, there's an Indonesian doctor who was there with me, and he was completely kind of, you know, very supportive and tried to close his eyes, but he wasn't dead, so he kept opening his eyes. And I know that he's not dying, so I just said, okay, fine, give it some few minutes, he will never survive. So I stayed with him for 2 minutes, holding his head and looking in his eyes, and he snored 2 minutes, and then he gone. After that, I went crazy. Went downstairs, and I found 3 bodies downstairs, blood all over, slip of blood. I was covered with blood. My friends were covered with blood. And you've got this old man weaving his son on the ship. Like, literally, you don't know how many injured, you don't know how many dead. And it's noisy. The fire alarm is still on. You've got people screaming. You've got people crying. It's like a horror scene. And then you realize, okay, you know what? After they kill 3 people, trust me, this will be like any other number will be number. They killed 9, 19, 29, 39. What matter, what the media will be reporting on, they killed a group of people in international water. So we decided that's it. I mean, that was decided before the captain and the captain Bolin, the leader of this flotilla, announced that, you know, he took his white t-shirt, sent it back, and the soldier were still firing. The soldier were, at that point, it was what, 5:30? Was 5:30 or maybe earlier. Maximum 6 in the morning.
Earlier.
Yeah. Like, okay, not even 5:30. Like, you're talking about, you know, let's say 5:30. We could still hear fires until the morning. They're firing. We don't know how many people are missing upstairs. A 19-year-old Furkan, you can see his pictures online when he was executed.
Mm-hmm.
He was shot and then they shot 5 times in his head.
5 times.
He was 19 years old, dual citizenship guy, American and Turkish. He was completely executed. My friend Ekram, who had his wallet in his pocket, he was shot from up, and you can see the bullets coming, the angle of the bullets. And he was shot in 23 into his heart. He didn't die. He's still critical, but nobody knows anything about him until now, what's going to happen to him or not. That's him. I mean, just all this kind of opportunity of peace and solidarity that these people, this group of people were about to deliver was completely diminished in the blink of a second. We didn't know that we were being observed by the rest of the people in the world. We thought they managed to cut us out of the world, and we tried to kind of you know, remain as strong as possible, trying to kind of calm ourselves, support each other, and we completely were sitting on the chairs waiting for the next move, which was obviously, we didn't know what it is. Just to finish quickly, I'm an ICE, which means International Solidarity Movement, and I know the technique of nonviolence. So despite all the anger and all the hate that I had at that point, I realized I need to kind of make a communication with the soldiers and try and understand what the hell they want next, because they were surrounding us and we were inside. So I approached them from another different direction by, you know, putting my hand behind and just pushing them and then turning and talking to them. And then basically they were clear, okay, we need you to get out of this saloon. We've got like at least 450, maybe 500 people sitting on these saloons. And just to visualize it to you, you know, it's just like a fairy. So each saloon will be like three sides of this room, maybe. Three sides of this room. And it's divided by a corridor in the middle. And this corridor will be this passage. And there's, you know, two sides. This side we created and it's converted to a hospital kind of thing. So we've got injured people lying all over, about 39 of them. And then you've got the seriously injured people on the floor waiting to be taken somehow. And then you've got the rest of people sitting here and also in the next door saloon. And the soldier was in this door. So I was talking to this soldier and he basically said, we need you all guys to be out in 10 minutes. And I was like, yes, thank you. We can be teleported in 10 minutes. What do you mean? You want 500 people to go out from this room in 10 minutes? Are you crazy? I said, no, I want you one by one to go out of this room. So anyway, so I was negotiating with them that, you know, it's crazy and, you know, we will get the rest of the people who are not injured to leave from the other side, and that's, you know, will take as much as we'll take, because they will just strip you and make and search you and stuff. And for this saloon, I was begging him to kind of allow some time, because there's some injured. Two doctors were performing a live operation on two injured guys with an anesthetic. One of them, I'll just come to his story later. So anyway, then he was convinced, okay, fine, if everybody's leaving from the other side, you've got 5 minutes to evacuate the injured. And I was like, it's kind of crazy, you know, it's inhuman for you to think this way. We need your help, you know, you have to give us some stretchers and you need to, you know, to get your medic and you need to, you know, if you're a human being, you would understand. Anyway, so I was negotiating backwards and forwards with another Palestinian woman who's a member of the Knesset in Israel, Hanim Zarbi, who was amazing. And we managed to convince him that we need more time. If you talk to me, if you look in my eyes, you know, we are under control. We're not going to resist. And we'll do whatever you want us to do. But you need to understand we can't just create miracles. And I don't want to be responsible for somebody's dying because I've ordered other guys to move him to the wrong direction or to do something wrong to him. So he understood a little bit. And we managed to get everybody out of the room. Some of the injured guys who could walk, they didn't want to be treated by the Israeli soldiers, so they preferred to go with the rest of the team. And the final number that was allowed to stay in that big saloon was, just remembering now, three doctors, me and Hanin, and the 15 injured. Now the doctor insisted that he needed to have a nurse, you know, because he was performing an operation. They wouldn't allow it, and then we basically forced another nurse to come and help them. The soldiers came and they were like absolutely inhuman, very insensitive to any of the conditions. We had people shot three bullets in their chest and they're internally bleeding and they were put on one side so the blood would not go to their lungs. And we tried to explain to them, if you flip this guy, the blood will go to his lungs and he will die. I don't know how many, somebody died or not out of that. But and these guys have complete fractions. If you move him, it will be very dangerous and he will just not care. So the doctor's explaining to him the conditions of each single patient and he's not really interested. He just will basically look in their eyes and make sure they're moving and whatever, and he just go and find this one and this one and this one. And what will happen next, basically, you'll have a sleeping bag or a blanket, and the soldier will just take, chuck them in the blanket, screaming in pain, and then they will take them out to the helicopters just to evacuate them because that's what they were interested in. Anyway, trying to smooth the situation as much as I could, and the last injured guy who was being, you know, he was shot in his genitals and he couldn't urinate for a long time. And he was exploding. And the doctor, and he was screaming. And the doctor, while performing an operation on him without anesthetic, just basically inserting pipes in here and trying to get him to release. And this guy is completely like out of it. Like he doesn't know what's happened. You know, the doctor was really trying to make the point that like, these guys, you know, you don't touch him. Leave him here for a little bit. He should be behind and better. They're not interested. They beat the doctor, put him aside, took the injured, and this was thrown out in the floor, which I picked, and it's with me. I'm just trying to remind myself all the time why a doctor is being treated like this. He is nothing but a doctor. He's nothing but trying to help an injured guy. I don't know exactly where have you seen, apart from the Nazi regime, doctors being beaten in front of their injured being beaten in front of the doctors. And I said, this is the story of this one. I don't know, how am I doing time? Am I over time?
Fine, 2 more minutes.
Okay, so I need to sit down. I don't know, I can't go on for long because, I mean, there's lots of stories. I don't know, I'd be very interested to hear from your side of questions and stuff. But just to finish, then after it was difficult, I had a Palestinian map in my neck, and then they discovered that I've got a Palestinian map in my neck. And until that point, they were treating me as a British, yeah? As somebody who's kind of respected. But then when they realized I've got a Palestinian map in my neck, the whole story changed. They were challenging me to take it off by my hands. I refused. As a result of that, I was forced to the ground, beaten up, and then taken as a hostage or human shield. If it's in international conditions, I was forced to open all the doors, taken to the cabinets, and explore the steps and, you know, the upstairs, and you know, then taken down, and I was completely kicked, and you know, every 5 minutes they'll tell me, so you don't want to take it off. I was like, no, you take it if you want. And they didn't take it. They just, like, you know, they want me to take it with my hands. I don't know why. Significantly. Anyway, and then I was taken back to the ship. Upstairs, I found all my colleagues being, like, landed on the ground, under the sun, under the helicopters, which is still by that time coming and putting more soldiers. You know, the soldiers keep coming into the ship until what? Until maybe 12 o'clock or maybe 11 o'clock. And you think, I think there must be more than 400 soldiers in that operation. There were at least 2 submarines. I've seen white submarine next to the ship. I thought it's a piece of plastic, but according to what I've heard, it's a submarine. There's more than 10 helicopters, 400 soldiers to capture these civilian ships. It was a disgusting operation. Anyway, the first thing I've heard when I'm just forced into the ground is this old man begging them, please, can I go to the toilet? Can I go to the toilet? And then I look, and the Jazeera reporter next to me is also begging them. And I was like, what's going on? And they said, they've been asking these guys to go to the toilet for a long time. And he wanted to see that man there. He just beat on himself because the soldier was forcing him to beat himself. So there's at least tens of cases where people beat on themselves because they have not been allowed to go to the toilet. I lost it. I stand up, start shouting to this soldier who was completely like saying this and swearing at us in Hebrew. And he said, Benzana, and I was like, don't swear at people and stuff. I wasn't trying to instigate a reaction from my comrades who were completely terrified of this night. So I standing up. I was basically calling for a fight. And obviously I got the fight that I want. He starts stabbing me here and there. And of course he stabbed me 10 times. And then the people kind of, ah! And then I just wanted the reaction from here, reaction from there, reaction from blah, blah. And then we got the captain because everybody was making some noise. And at that point, the captain came and I told him, listen, you've got people here. Do you know what they're doing? They're doctors and professors at universities, journalists, and people with organization. They're not idiots. They're not like nothing. They're not animals. And obviously, this will be taken back to their communities. So if you have a drop of humanity, you'll speak to a soldier, ask him not to swear at us and take us to the toilet. Or take us to an area where we can do it without anybody else's witnessing. It's a simple thing. Anyway, so I was talking to this captain, who's the only one who didn't have a mask in his face, by the way. And I was looking at his eyes and telling him, okay, remember your daughter, remember your son, remember your mom, remember your father. If you have a simple drop of humanity, just do it and be a man. And then I went down on my knees and I just said, okay, fine, do whatever you want to do. And by that time, we were allowed to go to the toilet. But I didn't know what we had to go through this to go to the toilet. It's a simple thing. If you capture people, that's what you do. I'll stop here.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Sorry. We'll pick